This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. I've been quite busy lately. I've actually been going, and I've been busy with the family tonight. My son is upstairs reading to my daughter. Hopefully that goes well. So if you hear any screaming, I apologize, but they'll be probably fighting here in the next 5 to 10 minutes, unless he does an excellent job reading to her, which I don't know will happen. Let's see what's going on in my world. I'm on the road next week. I've got a couple projects on my personal property, and got my tractor back from a job that I've been working on and had a chance to go over to my own property, do some mowing. Ton of rain over here. We've had more, I don't know if we've had 15 or 16 inches of rain here in the past month and a half, but it's been really wet. So one of the plants that kind of really does well in those areas is Curly Dock. That takes over a large portion of the food plots on the north-facing slope, so it's already moist, but that rain really propagates that plant. If you think about it, if you look at that plant, it's got a deep tap root, and it's aerating the soil to allow rain to infiltrate. Every plant has a purpose. And so one of the things that we're trying to understand is, why are plants growing in the landscape? And again, it's serving a purpose. Hopefully the rain stops. I went over there and mowed. And just mowing the plant at the right time just prior to the full development of that seed, that is when the best time to take that plant out. I try not to use any chemical herbicides. Mowing is your friend. If somebody tells you not to mow, particularly in your food plots, depending what's existing in that food plot, they're doing a disservice to you. You need to think consciously about these tools. My number one resource with most of my clients is recommending flail mowers. I love flail mowers. They're ease of use, well-constructed flail mowers that you can chop down pretty good size saplings with, etc. So you can use them for multiple purposes. And today that was one of my purposes that I was working on, and getting rid of wild parsnips. A little early to be doing that. I want to wait for the next 2 to 3 weeks to take that plant out. Usually wait till it's past flower stage. It's not even at flower stage at this point, or it's nearing it, I guess. But you want to take it out sometime thereafter. And smooth broom, one of the plants I'm dealing with quite often, it's just starting to finally do its final seed set stage, and it's ready to basically drop that seed. So pay great attention to what you're dealing with on your landscape, and try to deal with it in your own way based on your approach and what works for you. So those are just some things that I was working on. That was all this morning. Or yesterday morning. I'm getting my mornings mixed up. I was 5:15 in the morning yesterday morning. I'm working on my property because that's all the time I have. All right, Travis Harmon's back from Creative Habitat. It's been a while since I've had him on the line. We're going to talk about his property. Last we spoke, he had purchased a piece of property with a few individuals, and he was getting into the details of the design, his setup, and then he's been doing a bunch of work. So we want to follow up with him, his projects, just kind of learn from his strategy and technique. So let me get him on the line. Travis, what's going on, man? How you been?
Hey, John. It's great to be back. Great to talk to you. And great to talk to your guest. Been doing real good. Got an interesting story for you. One of my customers, third-year customer, so he's got a wildflower planting. The guy doesn't hunt. Great guy named Steve. Shout out to Steve. He said, when I contacted him this spring, he said, "Oh, well, by the way, I ran across a podcast interview that you did." He said it was on a Whitetail Landscape podcast. He said he thought it was great information, commented on your ability to ask tough questions and really drill the guest for information. So I thought that was really neat because he's not a hunter. Really odd that he would run across that podcast. So it's nice that it's still out there, getting information out and people are accessing it.
That's awesome. Cool. Yeah, thanks, yep. Man. That makes me feel good. And, kudos to you, right? All the guys that contribute to this are huge. And I've been kind of going in a roundabout way, talking a whole host of different people, not the core group of guys a bit on this podcast typically. And I'm trying to bring it back around full circle. I've just been bringing different guests on. And, in my journey through this, I guess I'm going through my own personal development and doing this. I'm trying to grow and grow and grow. And you just want to have different perspectives. I'm on travel next week. And I've got another training that I'm going to go to. Actually, I got an event I'm going to Saturday. It's a local event here in just Trumansburg, just in Ithaca area that I get to kind of connect with. But it's really kind of bringing communities together, man. And that's been my reach in. And people are contacting me all over the country to come work on their properties. Like, I'm not like local to New York anymore. And that puts a big toll on my time away from home. You know how that is. You're traveling a lot. So, and I think it's kudos to the podcast and guys like you. We're all connected, and I want to give opportunities to other guys through this and vice versa. So it's just worked out well.
Right there at the beginning, I want to back you up on a couple points you made.
Yep.
So you talked about when you were in there doing some cutting just before the weed went to seed. So a great piece of advice there. I use that strategy quite often, especially when you're not using herbicides. If you want to do it manually with cutting activity, the timing of those activities is critical for success. So that was a great piece of advice. And then the flail mower. So I run a bush hog, and I experienced the problems with the tires running in front. So any kind of side mower, flail mower, sickle bar, that really is the optimal way to cut, to manage weeds. And if you're applying herbicides afterward, you have the tire roll down and stuff, a lot of issues with that. So definitely, if you have the opportunity, when you're buying a piece of equipment, consider a side cutting piece because there's a lot of advantages to that, for sure. So great advice.
Awesome. So let's connect on your property. And if folks don't remember, please go back and listen to that podcast. I'm starting to label the podcast with numbers. I don't remember what podcast number that was, but it was probably 40 or 50 ago. I'm thinking maybe it was 30 ago. I can't remember. But if they want to go back and listen to that, please go do that. Now, your property, let's just go quickly through the demographic of your property, and let's work into some of the activities that you're doing that are improving it for whatever purpose, and we'll kind of just drill into that.
Sure. Really interesting developments over there at the property. So it's a WRP piece, 97 acres total, roughly a 30-30-30 mix of 30% water, 30% prairie, and 30% tree planting. The overall project is going on 9 years old. So it was farmed previously, flooded out periodically. They put it into the program, came in, broke tiles, flooded it out permanently, and then planted the trees and the prairie grass. So it's at a great, point at successional growth. We might have missed the prime. I would always consider, that 4 to 7 year period as being some prime habitat, but we're still in some really good stuff and really nice, diverse planting. Of course, it was a government project, so, it's funded well and laid out pretty decent. So we purchased it from the original owner. Of course, the contract transfers over to us. And, we work with the NRCS office on improvements. Any ideas for food plots, there's regulations and rules that we needed to stay within. And, just about every deal like that, whether it's CRP, WRP, you're dealing with a particular person at the office. And there's some interpretation to those guidelines. You might find in different areas, people are interpreting those differently. And so we actually had a change in our contact at the NRCS office here about 6 months ago. Actually, when the whole Elon Musk, Doge cuts were going on, that's when our guy got cut and we had a new guy come in. And so he definitely brought a little bit different perspective. And so it's a pretty large piece, no food plots at all. The previous owner didn't really do a lot of habitat improvement. So a lot of invasive had moved in, a ton of cottonwood, invasive cattail. I mean, a great piece of habitat, diverse wildlife, but it definitely needed to be managed. Of course, we're all about that, so we was ready to tackle it. But we're talking, it's going to take us 3 to 5 years, really, to get the property in order. And so we kind of staged it out, developed a plan for the overall property, and then began to approach it last year. First year was all about putting in clover, perennial food plots, establishing the hunting blinds. We did work on some cottonwoods last year, but we really hit those heavy this spring, going in and taking them out because the oaks and pines grow a lot slower than the cottonwoods. So if they were to let go, they would really start doing some damage in the next 10, 15 years. So we wanted to definitely address those, understanding it's going to take us years to get, across the entire property. But this year, we're definitely moving into more of the annual food plots. So we started to prep those last year in the fall because you're talking pretty fallow ground. Definitely wanted to try to get ahead of it. So we did some prep last fall. And then we're moving into expanding the food plots, putting in annuals, and then really trying to propagate birds. So northern Indiana is not very well known for pheasant habitat, quail, because there's good wetlands on the place, lots of waterfowl. But we're really focusing on the pheasants and quail because we don't have the habitat that supports those populations. And when you find those in our area, they are absolutely a real gem. And so we're putting a lot of focus on the upland improvements and really propagating the birds, nesting locations, managing the predators, nest predators. And we're really already starting to see an impact. Of course, first year we did zero improvements, just really did a lot of observation. We didn't actively hunt the place, just ran a lot of cameras, did a lot of observation, and let it lay as a sanctuary. because our area is super high hunting pressure. And so we wanted to start to let those animals know that this was going to be a safer place. And so the first year was all about just observation. And I'm glad we did that because we learned a lot about the way the movement across the landscape, how the neighbors were impacting the place. And then we could start coming in with our improvements, adjusted our layout a little bit from where our original thoughts were, and then we're just progressing through that. But the good thing is the new guy comes in and wanted to inspect the place, assure that we were abiding by all the regulations as far as 5% food plots and trails and, you know, all that jazz. And so he came in, did the inspection. Super great to work with. We definitely needed to change a few things according to his interpretation, which we were fine to do that. And so that is one important thing that I would mention to anybody coming into a contract like that. If you have a rep that is more relaxed on the regulations, just be advised that that can always change. And so stay flexible with your plan and just be aware that that interpretation of the regulations can always change.
Great advice. Let's back up a couple key points here. And you mentioned the 5% in food plots. Let's go back. So areas that were fallow or had remained fallow for a period of time, without going through every, you know, detail of how you reclaim those areas for food plots specifically and your prep that you did last year, maybe just detail some of the steps that you think functionally make sense for somebody who's bought a piece of property, they're doing some observation, they're starting to do their layout specifically for food plots, again, keeping the percentage in mind based on the layout here that you have. What are some of the preparatory things you did with your food plot?
So definitely being able to bush hog and do an initial cut is important. If you're using herbicides, you want to be able to apply those, understanding that the perennial plants are tough to kill. Annuals are pretty susceptible to herbicide applications, but perennials, you're going to have to expect multiple applications across the period of time to really get it clean. You know, farm fields, and it's a struggle even for myself. You see the farmers go into the fields, nice, clean, crisp fields, and they're maintained and look great. And then you're struggling with transforming a fallow location into something that looks like that. You just got to understand it's going to take time. And that's why we could have chose to come in and try to plant something last fall. But basically, we just came in, started cutting, and started applying herbicides so that we could have initial kill first, a spring back. And then the fall is a great time to kill tough perennials, especially thistles and the like. Those are formidable foes for sure. But in the fall, they're taking nutrients down to the roots. And so it's a great time to get in there and prepare for next season's planting. On my strategy is always to plant after the farmers, especially I'm sure a lot of guys understand the struggles of a small plot where you got higher populations of wildlife using them. Turkeys can do a ton of damage at the early portion when you put your seed in the ground. I've absolutely had them wipe out plots. Deer, especially on crops like soybeans that are susceptible to browse pressure, corn can really get hit hard early on. So in that case, I try to let the farmers plant first, let those fields get going, and then I'll come in on the backside planting a lot of soybeans and corn after the deer are more focused on the larger ag fields. Doesn't always solve our problem. And so I'm just now getting into heavy soybean and corn planting, starting to get toward the back end of it, but I definitely don't start up until after the farmers' fields are good and established. So that's currently where we're at on those. I've sprayed them twice this spring already. And, you know, the first year I really like to work the soil because if I'm doing any type of amendments, I want to get that down to where the roots are going to be at. And so it breaks up. We have a lot of clay pan around here. And so the first time going in, I like to cultivate, you know, disc, till, really work the soil aggressively, and then try to not do that in subsequent years as long as possible. So this year I'll definitely be ripping those and, you know, tilling them complete, then seeding. We're actually going to do buckwheat, sorghum, and then follow up in the fall with rye, some, you know, fall blends, brassicas. And the, my plot strategies are, I like to do some architecture to them. So just like a lot of guys, I'm sure, that are listening, screens, different varieties. I like small plots that can distribute, really. I'm all about the does. I know there's varying opinions on that, whether you should be building a doe factory or setting it up only for fall movement. Lots of opinions there. I'm looking to attract the maximum amount of wildlife, including does. In the fall, I believe the bucks are going to be where the does are at. And so that's normally how I try to manage the properties. And if you disperse your food plots, small plots across the property, especially the perennial clovers, because the does are going to be on those in the summer when they're raising the fawns. If you have just one of those, there's lots of competition. So I like to spread those out with individual bedding areas that associate with those plots. That way I can gain more does on my properties in the summer. And in the fall, they're going to be there in the fall, and that's when the bucks are going to come. So same with the annual plots. I like to break those up. If the property's favorable for a destination plot, I'll go in and do something like that. But this place is not really favorable for destination, so we've broken up the annual plots to smaller ones. And so probably in the next few weeks, I think I'll have those planted. A lot of people feel rushed, I think, to get the annual food plots planted because they see the farmers out in the field. I actually prefer later planting, not only for the browse pressure, but I like my beans to be green when the other bean fields are browning down. That's a lot of attraction power in the fall if you can get beans through to the fall. But that's a great advantage of also planting late.
Yeah. That one thing to mention is some of the techniques I've had, or I've employed at least with clients with the soil remediation tactics, is we are getting longer green periods of beans, which may be a detriment to some folks that are really like itching to get in, like maybe a cover crop, you know, in between rows. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into those late season food strategies. Now, I want to break you back to a point you were starting to make, talking about some of the core habitat or design setup for pheasants. We've talked maybe briefly pheasants on this podcast, but there's a big, you know, I guess, push or interest in this particular animal on the landscape. And, you know, it really needs kind of these kind of, there's really kind of like five core principles behind design for pheasants. And they need to have adequate escape cover. If anybody's done any hunting of pheasants, that's probably paramount to pressure. Adequate food sources, winter food sources, winter cover, broodering habitat, no different from quail, turkeys, and then proper nesting cover. And so a lot of times in these, I'll say these variable sites where there's a lot of, we'll just say demographically, we talked about earlier, you know, there's watered areas, non-watered areas, or upland, dryland, those type of areas. There tends to be a lot of variation or indices of variation. And so you want a dense woody cover component, cattail, shrub thickets, kind of these weedy areas for insects, dense grasses, short, tall grass prairies, those type of things become these kind of ideal habitats. And I could probably go through a whole host of plants that I would recommend on the landscape, but I'm not working on your property specifically. What are you doing for pheasants? Because I think pheasants is a big deal. I hear more and more about, you know, hey, I want pheasants on my property. I want them to survive the winter months. We'll still do a stocking regime that we have, you know, in the spring period. Just, you know, what are you thinking when it comes to pheasants?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on with some of your recommendations there for habitat. Around here, my experience is that the habitat that really where the pheasants were at, cattails. So that provides some great winter cover. And in the fall, when we was kicking up pheasants, a lot of times it was near cattail habitat. Also giant ragweed. We found them a lot in those kind of locations. So just dense cover that stands throughout the winter because they're super vulnerable in the winter months. So having that quality winter cover is important. So we are definitely working to maintain the diversity across the property. So I mentioned it's about 9 years old. No maintenance was done prior. So so a lot of that open habitat, the prairie area, the warm season grasses have seriously degraded. You got a ton of goldenrod in there. And so that's not great habitat. And so we definitely want to improve those open grassland areas because that's where it's weak right now. So this spring we were focused on removing a lot of the cottonwoods that were throughout those areas, treating the stumps, which is super important because if you don't do that, you're going to double your problem. And so we made sure to do that. And then use those cut downs to build brush piles and hopefully some nesting cover. That was the intention. So using the scraps to help improve nesting. And then also the annuals that we're planting focus on that winter food component. We're driving, you know, the buckwheat, sorghum, those kind of things that they really like. So I noticed in the past I've had issues with planting buckwheat and the pheasants really hitting those plots hard. So I have a couple properties that have good pheasant habitat that I either manage or like this one own. We tried to propagate some pheasants on the one because we've been there 7 years now and we've never heard a pheasant there the first 4 years. It's excellent habitat. And so we decided to raise some, did a release also while working on the habitat. And we actually heard the first one there last fall. We did a release there 2 years ago. And so whether or not that was, you know, part of what we propagated, who really knows? We released 75 birds on that property, incubated them, raised them as chicks, put them out, which was a great experience. It was lots of fun. I would definitely recommend that to anybody who's interested in propagating birds on their property. But hopefully that was part of the reason why we heard one there. We're not going to do any propagation on this property. It already has a good enough wild population that we don't want to take the chance of introducing any types of new diseases or anything like that. So we're just looking to build on what's already there. With our food plots, winter food, and then focusing on maintaining grasslands, we were wanting to get a little bit more aggressive with the cattails. But because of the usage with the pheasants, we're backing off some of that cattail control that we was planning on doing.
Now, you have cottonwoods, you said. Are there any upland dryland sites? Is that where you're trying to rid those in those particular areas?
So, unfortunately, there is cottonwood dispersed absolutely throughout the entire property. it was seeded in by cottonwoods from across the road. On the south side, and we have a southerly predominant wind, so it's going to be a constant problem for the entirety of that property. But we're just focusing on the areas first that we can tackle based on a priority. And over time, I would say maybe 5 to 7 years, we'll have made it across the entire property and removed the majority of the larger cottonwoods. And then it gets much easier to maintain if you stay on top of it in the future.
Yeah. Quail. And I know that's probably another interest point for you. Having, you know, my experience with working with landowners with quail, and I don't want to pretend like I'm you know, this person that has all the answers, but, you know, creating more shrubby cover is a big component of kind of creating these covey headquarters or scenarios for that particular, you know, bird. When it comes to doing some of your layouts, and I think that's something you were focused on, are you trying to allow brambles to creep in, you know, some use of brush piles, maybe introduction, I'm thinking plums, dogwood thickets, hazelnuts might grow in your area, maybe not hazelnuts that great. Sumac's probably common in some of the areas if you can propagate it well. What are you looking to do for quail specifically?
Yep, so quail definitely take advantage of similar habitat to the pheasant, so we're definitely helping both at the same time. This property does not have a lot of soft mats, so that's one thing that was lacking. They didn't plant a lot of those types of trees, no fruit trees or anything like that. And so first year, right out of the gate, we started to establish soft mast trees. We're definitely bringing in raspberry cuttings and things like that because it doesn't have a lot of bramble either. And so we're all about the diversity, pockets of diversity that spread it out across the property. So we're basically focusing in on 2 to 3 acre chunks and improving those across different locations across the 60 acres of dry grout. That's our strategy now. Then there's always the sanctuary. So we've dedicated at least 25 acres there as sanctuary area that we don't plan to do any improvement in there after the initial removal of cottonwoods and regeneration of the warm season grasses. We'll just be staying out of there. That'll be primarily just bedding area and sanctuary.
Travis,
so they're kind of at the fend for themselves in that area.
So when it goes to the sanctuary, we're talking about a sanctuary for a multitude of animals, but specifically for deer, I'm assuming, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. All the animals, I believe, figure it out eventually over a, you know, generation upon generation being born into that. So by the time you get to year 5 or 6, I believe with the sanctuary, you really start to see the difference because of those generations that are born into that.
So creating an ideal cover component of those sanctuaries where there's, you know, habitat, food, and cover in combination, what does that look like in your particular area, minus the cottonwoods at this point, per the removal?
Sure. Dogwoods are always a favorite. Shrubby, woody browse. Normally, I'm driving my sanctuary toward thick winter cover because we have high hunting pressure in the fall. That's when that sanctuary is most important. In the summertime, the sanctuary is actually up toward the houses. So you'll find the does want to keep their fawns up near structures, up near the roads, because the main predator in the summer is the coyotes. And so that's where they're safest from them. But quickly in the fall, they transition to those deeper spots that are in thick cover. And so we're all about thick grasses, briars, regeneration, you know, everything below 5 foot and below is what we're trying to keep the thickest layer of cover.
Now,
so we want to keep things immature.
Okay. Now let's back up for a second. Let's go through the process of how to create access within these sanctuaries that's functional. So you have that correct volume of cover, adequate movability or I guess mobility within an area, plus the layering effect that gives them that food component with a cover component combination. So can you kind of just describe maybe in detail, let's take a 100-foot by 100-foot area and just maybe describe to me what you think that should look like in an ideal, or maybe specifically what your property looks like at this point.
Yep. So I definitely do not do any type of planting activity in what I would deem as the sanctuary area or bedding area. That's going to be mostly native or natural browse. I want them to feel safe in there, stay in there during the day, but I want the more ice cream plantings, you know, the favorable food plot stuff to draw them out of that. That's the objective, and kind of control their movement as they're generally headed to the larger ag fields. You can't compete with the large ag fields. And so the food plots are more just to draw them from those sanctuaries and guide the movement to the ag fields. But inside the sanctuary, you know, grasses, I'm not really focused on a food component. You're going to get that while you're trying to keep the cover down toward the ground. And I like bedding pockets. And so if I'm dealing with a mature woods, we're building the sanctuary inside a mature woods. Number one, the first activity is, can we log it? And so to open up that canopy and thicken the ground cover, that's going to be the first activity. If I'm dealing with open territory, I'm looking to create pockets of cover. And so I want thick cover with some kind of pocket opening where the deer, if they're primarily focused on deer, feel comfortable laying inside that, but can see some distance, some visibility inside the pocket, but definitely surrounded by thick cover.
Can you give?
And I'm not looking. Yep.
Can you give a description on what the distance you believe the deer should see within those pockets in a field setting that's adequate for them?
So definitely depends on the lay of the land. We live in a lot of flat ground, and deer tend to want to bed up on hills where they got visibility way out in front of them. Wind at their back, can see danger coming. But in thick areas, flat ground, at least 30, 40 yards you know, that kind of distance. I think they like that type of visibility. But you're going to find deer laying in thick cover switchgrass that can't see 2 foot in front of them. So, of course, they're going to move their bedding locations. But in that type of scenario, when I'm talking, I'm coming into a blank canvas and I'm looking to put trees in, I'm generally going to create pockets, maybe 20, 30 yards wide, where I'm focusing those tree plantings in a V shape, some kind of U shape that leaves open distance, 30, 40 yards as the legs go out, something like that, that yeah. creates that type of pocket, thinking about what is that going to look like in 8 to 10 years when you're putting in that 1.5 foot tall tree.
I love this. This is very similar to the descriptions that I give to clients. And one thing I will say is there could be a layering component within these bedding areas and a space component that's really critical to their interests. And you said something really, I think, important is look at what the terrain features currently provide deer. If you're in an open setting and the deer have a preference, again, it depends a lot on the landscape, the volume of pressure, their vigilance in an area, it may contract their movements, it may expand their movements. So perceptually, you have to understand what a deer thinks in his domain and how he perceives his environment. Because deer that are a little bit risk adverse may use a component of cover. They may use more of a component of sound or more may of a component of smell as well in that combination to give them that right kind of framework and setting as they pick their bedding locations. And that when you talk about guys that are killers, and I don't, you know, I'm not going to put myself in that category, but guys that are killers and that are dialed, that understand deer movement very, very well, they know where the deer exist when they exist in those particular areas. They can dial in. And they're using all these prescriptive ideas of how deer use terrain features and why they perch themselves in a certain location. And if they can visualize that and visualize how they move in the landscape, you as a landowner, take the same principles and start applying it to your habitat changes, and you'll be amazed at the outcome of how deer use certain areas at certain times. And then you could prescriptively kind of have a plan ahead when you're going to kill the deer in that area. And I'm just taking these points that you're putting together, and just, it makes a whole lot of sense, because we talk a lot on this podcast, and I talked to a gentleman the other day that called me, and it was about removing invasives. I mean, it was 99.9% of the conversation about removing invasives. And I said, I think that's a huge part of just managing your domain, but you actually have to think about the bigger picture behind what your property provides an animal. And if invasives are a negative and they're distracting your ultimate goal, then sure, that's part of the, I guess, prescription that you want to work through. But picking those key locations where deer want to bed and determining those sanctuaries, sometimes the sanctuaries where the deer most frequently want to be. And most of the time, my clients want to be in those locations to hunt those deer. And it just, the combination of that never works out well. They're never successful. And I think that's a lot of the failures that I'm seeing, at least over the years with the clients. And I've said this multiple times in the podcast. And please, clients, please don't get offended at this. Just be open. Almost, I want to say 80% of the properties I go to, I don't even have to locate the bedding areas. The tree stands dictate where the deer are. And guys are overhunting the sign, and they're using sign to predict what they as hunters are going to do, and not letting the deer come to them and not building the right layering effect or putting deer in the right location so they are comforted by kind of all these other things that we kind of mentioned here in the discussion. So I just want to kind of add that to the equation.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned hunting the sanctuary, and I struggled with that a little bit at first. I like to hunt a lot, and you know, I always did ever since owning my property. And so it's absolutely necessary that I have a sanctuary that I don't intrude on. Now, with some of my customers, they may only hunt 2 or 3 times a year. Well, that's a little bit differently. I hunt my sanctuary 2 to 3 times a year. When it gets prime time, I'm definitely going in there if I have to. I'm hoping to be tagged out before I have to do that, but I'm definitely willing to go in there. But I'm only disturbing it 2 or 3 times throughout the hunting season. And so if a customer only hunts 2 or 3 times a year, it's a defunct sanctuary automatically because it's not being disturbed. The entire property really is. So I definitely give advice differently on that, on the purpose of the sanctuary and how you utilize it. And so it definitely depends on your frequency of hunting as well.
Yeah.
But back to the shape, I definitely use the U and the V shape. If I'm even working inside of a woods and my focus is to open the canopy, generally I like to have loggers come in and do the heavy lifting first. And then I like to come in behind that, take out some of the smaller trees, again, using the scraps to build brush piles and those kind of things. But I'm usually using some type of U or V shape to open an area, build brush piles in that type of shape, because I believe deer really like to use the wind at their back. And if you a V or a U gives them lots of different options to be on a point with the wind at their back. And just like with the terrain, if I'm going to improve some bedding on a hillside, I'm looking to identify the bench or the point and then focus improvements on that, because that's where the deer is naturally going to want to be anyway.
Yeah. One thing, Travis, to mention is you can build these as well. You know, I've been known to take terrain features that are unusable and make them usable with dozers and excavators. And actually, on my own personal property, I've been doing it by hand. And I know that seems kind of crazy, but if you're insane enough to want to stack deer in a location or want deer to use a particular area at a maximum rate, you're going to be willing to do whatever it takes to get deer in those areas. It's just a matter of fortitude and interest. And you know, I keep telling everyone that that tool that I have, it's like kind of a Maddox tool, Rogue 7-inch hoe. That thing has been tremendous in building, you know, bedding areas specifically, and even, you know, carrying out some activities outside of just building bedding areas. I mean, I use it for harvesting all sorts of different things, taking roots out, just a whole host of work. So I would just employ people, get out there and start to realize what areas they're using, start to put some information together on when they use those areas, your structure example and form, you know, using the back cover as a means for protection as well as wind disturbance can be absolutely an objective that you could create in a small little nook and cranny in your property, stacking deer, you know, presently. One of the things I focus on and how would I get big bucks on my property, not only do I focus on having good quality soils in these bedding areas and having the right structure and food content, and we have tried to hit a food content percentage, but I focus on making sure they have as much fiber as they can in their diet. And, you know, they are slaves to their stomach, and there's certain plants that they have high preferences. And one of the points earlier is when you have these wet areas or these lowland areas, bottomwood hardwoods, if you're just treating a bottomwood hardwood stand as kind of like a monocrop, future timber harvest, I see a lot of people go in, it's like, oh, the timber is beautiful down here. And, you know, they say, don't disturb it. We don't want to create any disturbance in and around kind of the wet areas. And that's a good, I think, prescription. But you can be selective in your cutting, and that could be some of the most fertile soil on your entire property. So I would just, you know, push people to make the right decisions and kind of play with those levers, creating the right cover, you know, whether it's winter cover, summer cover, you know, food value in those particular areas so you can drive movement and interest. And I think, Travis, you hit it out of the park with creating shapes and formats that the deer are going to prefer. And really the terrain kind of dictates that as well as the structure that you're playing with on the landscape.
Absolutely.
All right, we're getting towards the end of this. I told you I wouldn't keep you forever because I know you got stuff going on tonight, but I want you to leave the audience with something either revolutionary or something that you feel, you know, changed your mindset when you've been working on your property, something just different that hit you when you were kind of going through the process of design or working that I think folks would benefit from.
So my best piece of advice is patience. So patience is one of the hardest things to manage, but it's one of the most critical things when you're dealing with habitat. A lot of the times you're out working and you're really working and the payoff is going to come later, whether it's 6 months, a year, 5 years, 7 years. And so that can get difficult sometimes to have to wait for those fruits to come. But stay patient. And then also don't get too much in a rush to throw all your improvements out at once. You're going to learn over time how the animals want to use it, how they're reacting to your improvements. You know, fruit trees are important to get in quick because, you know, it takes years for those to produce, but some of your other improvements, you can definitely take your time on that so that you can adjust and be flexible. The environment's going to change. Your population of animals is going to change. You start off low and you start building numbers. Things are going to happen differently. And so you just got to stay flexible.
Travis, I actually need a little advice. So I want to add one more thing into this, and I got a question for you. So, and I've been meaning to do this. I've just been, like I said, in the catch of doing a lot of different work recently, but I was going to put a pollinator planting in my backyard. I missed my cool season plan, which was going to rid myself of cool season grasses in the yard. And I'm into the warm season now. Am I too late if I spray now and don't hit again in the, I'll say, August, September timeframe, taking out those cool seasons? Is it a bad move to kill now and then, you know, spread those seeds out after I've burned a small area? Should I wait till next year to plant those, maybe just post-spring period after I've gotten rid of some of the cool seasons, either in the fall or early spring? Would that be a better tactic for me, at least long-term?
You know, I don't know, John, I'm kind of a gambling man. I'd probably go ahead and try something. I'm still planting now.
Okay.
So, in fact, June is my favorite time to plant.
Right. Wildflowers. You said that before. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolute prime time to establish. And especially on a lawn grass situation, if you've kept it mowed for years, you've had good broadleaf control there. Grasses are not a problem in flowers, so I would start burning it down. I'd maybe spray it twice. I'd go ahead and kill it and then wait for a bounce back. If it was a small area, I would encourage that bounce back by watering, and then I would kill it again, and then I'd look at starting to seed. You know, I even have to kill plantings that I feel like the seed beds have been well prepared because too many weeds come in. There's a lot of different variables that impact germination, so don't be afraid to go ahead and throw seed on it. If it comes in bad, you can always kill it and put more seed on it. Nothing wrong with starting over. I've learned that you got to be okay with doing that. It's going to save you a lot of heartache later on, a lot of back labor, if you just accept I need to start over. Now, I say that knowing I sell seed, but I'll definitely sell it to you. So go ahead and try.
All right. I appreciate the advice. So thank you for that. And I'll give you some advice on the backside outside of this podcast for some new things that I'm working on. So hopefully it helps you in the field as well. But for everybody listening to this podcast, I appreciate, and actually the words that you started out with, that motivates me. You know, I'll just mention something just kind of out of the blue here is, you know, this podcast has created a lot of connections, and I've said that multiple times, and I appreciate everybody listening to this. You know, if you can take the time to go in and rate the podcast and give me a review, I think the titles are getting a lot of searchability, to your point earlier, but it's really having people connect with me and asking for advice. I mean, today I almost got 5 different questions for various clients today on different things that they were, you know, having problems with. And it's like, man, that's the thing that keeps my mind rocking. And I'm like, oh, all right, I got to think about this issue. That's kind of new, you know, you're kind of experiencing new problem sets and dealing with those. And I think through this podcast, we kind of address as many things as we can that we learn through. And, you know, there's now one size fits all. And when it comes to strategy, I think it's get out there and try new things and not being so myopic with your approach and try to be a little bit less, and we mentioned a bunch here on herbicides, but try to be conscious of the negatives that you're applying to your landscape. And if you worked your farm right 10 years ago and you were that far ahead, you know, 10 years later, and if you could have done things differently, I'm sure most people would approach things maybe with softer gloves or maybe more technical approach, and they were more mindful of things that they were doing. And that comes through a client conversation I had yesterday. So I really appreciate kind of your input, Travis. And, you know, hopefully everybody has a chance to buy some seed from you. So my link and your links will be in the bio of this and, excuse me, in the comment section. And so folks go in there and take a look at those and, you know, get a hold of Travis for seed. And, you know, if you need support, he's out of Indiana. He will come help you. And I'm sure you're traveling quite often to help folks. So, you know, just keep him in mind.
All right, man. I appreciate that.
All right, man. Well, thanks for catching up with me. And I like to catch up with you just before hunting season. So keep that kind of on your docket. And, you know, anything that you're working on from now to then that will be something that we'll hit on in that podcast.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, brother. Talk soon. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
New year, new me? Cute. But how about new year, new money? With Experian, you can actually take control of your finances. Check your FICO score, find ways to save, and get matched with credit card offers, giving you time to power through those New Year's goals you know you're going to crush. Start the year off right. Download the Experian app. Based on FICO score 8 model. Offers and approval not guaranteed. Eligibility requirements and terms apply. Subject to credit check, which may impact your credit scores. Offers not available in all states. See Experian.com for details. Experian.
LifeLock, how can I help?
The IRS said I filed my return,
but I haven't.
1 in 4 taxpaying Americans has paid the price of identity fraud.
What do I do?
My refund, though.
I'm freaking out.
Don't worry, I can fix this.
LifeLock fixes identity theft guaranteed and gets your money back with up to $3 million in coverage.
I'm so relieved.
No problem. I'll be with you every step of the way.
1 in 4 was a fraud-paying American. Not anymore. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.